I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Soul School, everybody. Today, my guest is a fellow podcaster, and I think covers a lot more territory than just podcasting, which we'll get into that. It's Stephen Hovetter. And Stephen, welcome to the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lisa. I'm so excited about a few weeks ago, like when my daughters, I was like walking out of the office, and she said, have a good work today and make new friends, which is a great like 3-year-old like sending into the world of work, you know, that like missional sending of my child was so great. And I reflected on that. I was like, man, I do get to like make new friends in the most unusual and unique ways all the time. And you are one of my new friends. So
yeah, absolutely. And that's what's so fun about doing this and then connecting to people all over the world. And you don't know who the next friend will be, and they can be so remote from, you would never ever meet them in regular life, and then you find out there's all these tie-ins. And I found your podcast, and you linked up to my podcast in one of your posts, and I was like, well, that was really cool, and what's he up to? And then I noticed there were a lot of crossovers and similarities. Yeah. And so maybe you can get into a little bit of what you're up to.
Okay, yeah, so I do. I am one of those people that, gets, chases things like a little squirrel, and I get really excited about something, and I'll just work the heck out of it for a while, and then I'll move on to the next thing. And, I like to think of myself as kind of a Renaissance man in that way, but it's really true that I just like shiny new things and, kind of chase whatever pops up in front of me. So the podcasting thing for me has been a really fun experiment, I guess, and kind of experimenting with a couple of different forms of what that might look like with spiritual steps. And then I do this other side one that's more a little bit more niche called The Craft of Ministry, and I use that for some just more like internal colleague kind of conversations. But this little piece of my journey kind of started by with really this desire to take kind of our message, not our message, that's a really pretentious way of saying that, but to take this like a formative piece of what I think it means for people to be engaged in a community that we call church, and mm-hmm. to take that piece of what it means to like be shaped into a certain direction. I felt like we needed a little bit different vehicle for particularly what was happening in our faith community at the time, okay? And specifically, like the way that all came about for me was that like last year we got to this place in our church here. We were kind of just having these internal conversations, and it became really apparent that a lot of our people, and this is not unique to us at all, but a lot of our people were so dominated by fears and anxieties, and it was like oppressive, mm-hmm. It was like this real oppressive sense. And, like fear is such a slippery thing, and you can't, it's like, you can't like just simply be educated out of fear.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I can't just mm-hmm. give you more information and then your fears and anxieties go away,
yeah.
right? Because it kind of works on this other level.
Right.
We also, in addition to our 3-year-old, we have a couple of 9-year-olds and a 2-year-old too, even though this isn't like family portrait time, but I feel like if I leave him out, I'm doing a disservice. So our 9-year-olds, mm-hmm. we were watching the first Star Wars, like episode 1, mm-hmm. Darth Maul. And an hour after bedtime, one of my 9-year-olds comes down and she's like, hey, I need to jump in the bed with you guys. It's like, no, you need to go to your own bed. But and so there's this negotiation that I have with my children all the time. And in this one, what I really want to say is, hey, like evil Sith lords aren't real. No monster is going to come into our house with a lightsaber and chop you in two. Like that's... Mm-hmm. There are a lot of real things to be kind of worried about, but that's not one of them. You're going to probably make it through the night in your own bed, mm-hmm. But you can't just give her like that rational this is a new set of facts. And if you take those, because her fears are coming from like this imaginative part of her brain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and so we, you know, I, like for me, some of the tools that we use most in the church, because they're, you know, if everything, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the tool that we've used the most is like this information exchange.
Mm, yeah.
You know, that kind of educational thing. And that's not the scope of education, but, and, you know, so we, but, and that just seemed useless in a way. It was like, we can't just, and I'll speak just very specifically, like, in our part, our conversation that has to do a lot of, like, with, like, just cultural change, anxiety about, like, cultural change, particularly in our, you know, rural American context, okay? And in particular, because of, I think, just a lot of rhetoric that's in the air, like anti-Islamic kind of stuff, Islamophobia kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's an article by a guy I know named John Barton that's been floating around called Islamophobia is more about, is more phobia than Islam.
Right, right, yeah.
Okay. And I wanted to, that was really kind of part of our quandary, right? Because I, on one hand, my gut instinct was to say, well, let's give people a real new, more useful perspective about a broad view of Islam. And once they understand that better, then they'll stop being afraid. But that's not, it's really
not
true.
Not what's going on. It's not actually what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, it may be part of, it's on the top of it. And it's what we can name most easily. Okay.
Mm.
Is that, but it's not just that they have these concerns about like this historical religious, you know, movement or, you know, they, what they're really concerned about is just this grieving, this sense of like cultural change in their own world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like this deeper anxiety and this deeper set of fears.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that to say, we kind of, as a faith community, our like leadership team, said, you know, instead of just trying to approach this all educationally, we need to find ways of engaging people on a deeper level with like formative spiritual practices that can begin to work at that fear and general anxiety on a different sort of level.
Yeah. And so the spiritual practices and you're talking about spiritual practices and disciplines mainly, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what?
And specifically prayer.
Yeah, yeah. And what that really drives at the heart at, even neuroscience kind of covers this as well on the sciencey data empirical side,
yeah,
is that it is actually rewiring certain areas of your brain.
Yep.
And so it's like, it's not just fluffy, like, wouldn't this be cute if we could all pray better? But it's actually, you can see the changes in the brain once you do image scans.
Yeah, absolutely. You're rewiring, you know, and in particular, that's why I'm in prayer as a discipline. Not necessarily, you know, the other spiritual practices sure have lots to do with this too. I think like a practice like hospitality, for instance, can work on this on another level.
Mm-hmm.
But prayer specifically has this capacity to, and just meditative, contemplative kind of prayer, okay, has this capacity to get at that anxiety piece.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other spiritual practices, you know, things like, you know, fasting or particular kinds of social, you know, connections and table, things like that, you know, have a way, may work at other, you know, other vices, like our tendency to be, you know, real consumptive, you know, creatures, know, greed and those kinds of things. Okay.
Yeah.
But one that I really was concerned about was this piece of fearful anxiety.
And,
and it seemed to me that, you know, not like you can just take these things like prescriptions, you know.
Well, right, right.
I need a little bit of this, so let me take 30 milligrams of prayer, well, you know. But,
yeah.
But there is a sense that, you know, that, you know, prayer seemed to be the piece that would, in the long run, not in 2 months, but over several years, we can really begin to kind of have a culture that is less susceptible to things, just fearful anxieties.
Yeah, we're talking about people getting sort of habitually neurotic, and then that really propagates. And then I think that whole idea of being conformed into the image of Christ and taking on the fruit of the Spirit isn't just this lofty religious language, but it's common life and doing stuff together in community. How do we want our community to act together and act out in the world? You know, it's like something we're going to do together. This is how we are in the world. And that's a whole missional piece, is that this isn't something that we're doing like a pep rally and then we're going to go back to being however neurotic we actually are.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
It's actually transformational. You know, it's actually forming us into different people for real.
Yeah,
you know,
shifting us into a different route, a different
way.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
And I don't know, you know, I'm, you know, proof of the pudding is in the eating, right? And we have, because we're on this track of something that we hope will take, really be fruitful over several years, it's mm-hmm. it's hard to tell how much ground we're gaining. But just anecdotally, you know, so that was the main track of getting into this Spiritual Steps podcast, that particular thing, okay? And then what's really, I guess, like ancillary, you know, to that, you know, just this added benefit that we weren't really thinking about, is that it begins to create these other connections with other people. Like, you know, that was really something intended for like our faith community, you know, and then I was at like our pool, like the community public pool here in town, the other day, and one of the teachers, like just that our kids had in school at some point, just randomly as she's like taking her kid over to the slide, was like, "Hey, I've been listening to your podcast." It's like, what? Oh. And you know, it's interesting to think about like what you produce. You get into these conversations. You begin and you produce something that's then can kind of take a life on its own. And you know, what a incredible mystery to think about how that piece of word, that piece of content, can then, you know, kind of become its own thing out in the world. You know, have its own fruit somewhere else. And I'm sure you have that kind of conversation too, where you know you have this piece. And like for some of your work in like for the kind of interviews and stuff that you do, you know, sometimes like you know, some of your fruitfulness of that work may be that, you know, one of your listeners connects with somebody else, you know, and then, you know, in some podcast that they produce, you know, maybe a year or two from now, there's some connection. I mean, that's a mysterious and, you couldn't chart that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I even wouldn't even want to. You just take that next step, and you know the next step is right, and then you,
yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's really interesting how it works, because there's just no way you would know where it would lead. But
yeah. So this happens all the time. And like my work is my normal work is a preacher, right? Mm-hmm. And I think most people men and women that I've talked to who are preaching, like they have this very common experience of, you know, having that sermon that or string of them that you feel is just terrible. Like you just feel like this is so this is not at all what I wanted to do, not at all what I was trying to say. It just didn't come out right. And then you'll invariably have somebody, like, you know, that day or even weeks later, be like, "Man, that was the most meaningful thing," and it's like totally changed my life, you know. Because there's a sense that when you release the word, you know, and you become like a conduit of this of a message like that, then you have to kind of turn it loose, you know. Mm-hmm. And what it kind of does, like your work is in producing and turning it loose, you know, and then you. You know, it just whatever happens to it after whatever that word can manage to do outside of you, it just happens.
Yeah, and that's kind of the part about co-creating that I've tried to stress a few times in different podcasts, and kind of what I'm up to with the idea of a muse or this divine co-creation that we're up to, is that we are really not 100% making things on our own. You know, we're kind of cooperating, and that we also are cooperating with other people and other collaborators and with the divine, and that it's not totally up to us, but it's not totally not up to us. And so
agency. Like you still are, you know, I mean, you still have to, you know, turn on the mic and get everything, you know, plugged in and, you know, then produce it and then, you know, get the feed right and all that kind of stuff. There is like all this mechanic, and you have choice, you have choice in agency, you know,
showing up
and all that. Yeah. And, and discernment to connect, you know, which routes you're going to connect and all that kind of thing. But then there is, I don't know, this metaphor's, I'm sure, overplayed, but, you know, like the parenting metaphor is very rich in this, right? Like, I mean, you do, as a parent, you do what you can with your child, and then you release them into the world. And mm-hmm. some of what happens is a result of your, you know, attentiveness to that task. And some of it is just the mysterious your relationship between their agency and the divine, and you know, and you're, I mean, it all is this soup together. But there is a sense that, like, what you're, and for me, my calling is not to manage a certain set of results. You know, it's to, like you say, take a next step, be faithful with what I have, and I really think that. So part of the human calling in the world is to take what we have and to create with it, and to join in, like, this creative impulse of the divine, you know, mm-hmm. to make something new, and then to, you know, release it into the world, and then sometimes it makes something newer, and on we go. And that's really, like, the essence of what it means. That's really central to what it means to be human to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why for me, I do get caught up in, like, all these other different little side projects, right? Is because there is a piece of where I, theologically for me, joining in with the spirit of creation is, I think that's part of who we are. And I don't want to make that, like, too artsy. Like, if you're not, you know, producing this certain form of art, then you're not part of the human calling in the world, you know. But for us, like, I think the divine calls us to join in. I think God calls us into being part of this impulse that creates the conditions for, like, life and mm-hmm. love and all that, and anything we do that kind of sustains or furthers that that's part of what it means to be deeply. That's deeply what it means to be human.
Yeah, and that can extend to hospitality and conversations and just investing yourself in someone else in service. And I think a lot of people think, you know, if I'm not painting beautiful pictures, I'm not a creative person. And, you know, creativity can just be investing your life somehow in someone else, like a teacher or a nurse or someone who has a bed and breakfast or something like that. It's all counting toward that, and that kind of is an interesting segue into your ideas of missional living and some of those choices that you've made to live missionally in the world. I wonder if you could speak a little bit toward that.
Well, yeah, okay. So I'm the missional piece for me is and you know, I could really, like, geek out on this, you know, in terms of what that particular language means in mm-hmm. the theological literature and all that. But, you know, for me, very simply, a missional life means, you know, joining in with what God is working to do in the world, okay? And very, at the most basic level, I do think that creating the world and filling it with life and love, sharing life, I think that's the divine mission, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think everything revolves around that. In our canon, in the story of Israel, the story of Jesus and the church, I think what God is doing is trying to create the conditions for life and love. And our kind of code for that is righteousness and justice, okay? And but those aren't just, like, these ritual notions. They are, properly understood, they are conditions for life. Like, life flourishes when there's justice, you know? Love flourishes when people have a properly understood sense of righteousness, you know, not just, like, judgmental piety. That's not what we mean by, like, that. That's kind of associated in those. But when we think about, like, the real, the old ancient notion of what it means to be righteous, it means to live in a proper relationship to yourself, the world, your neighbor, you know, and God. And when we have that, when you live in that kind of way, you there's just a different kind of condition for life and love to, you know, flourish. And so, for me, living missionally is about living in the world with my neighbors in a way that tries to provoke those things. Sometimes provoke's really the right word too, right?
Like, yeah.
Because sometimes, you know, It means like trying to help the faith community like wake up to what really it really means to be alive, you know, mm. or it means to challenge a notion of injustice that is, restraining the conditions of life. Mm. You know what I mean? Like that's kind of and so part of my work is to try to provoke that things in our particular faith community. I am in like a more, you know, it's pretty traditional, like institutional form of church. Okay, that's what our faith community is like. But we are trying to be on that track where we see ourselves as existing for the sake of our community, okay, for the sake of the expansion of life and love and all that stuff, and mm-hmm. the will of God, the kingdom of God in that language, mm-hmm. you know, for our neighborhood. And that doesn't mean, you know, just the I guess the notions of like, you know, proselytizing, making sure everybody shares this exact notions of faith that we have. What it really means is trying to look in our community and see what is causing death, you know, and what is causing hatred and conflict and all those things that just break mm. the world. Mm. And how can we push against those things, and how can we support the things that make for life?
Mm. Well, what does that look like in give me some examples of what that might look like and what you've done in terms yeah. of real stuff. Okay.
Yeah. I am talking to like 20,000 feet here. So come really down. Like for me, like one of the something that has happened in the last few years is like we take people, we try to walk with them and see what those things are that are kind of, you know, really oppressing them in a way, and it's still like too cloudy language. So, like for us in our community, there are these like pillars of just stability that make for life flourishing, and they're very simple things like affordable housing. Like you have a place that you can afford. You have the kind of work that gives you sustainable sort of income. Okay, you have enough of a relational network that you can depend on some people, and you have some sort of transportation, you know, mm-hmm. like, and you know, those things are like just pillars of stability, of like personal stability. And mm-hmm. so we'll do things like I do a lot of like life coaching kind of stuff, I mm-hmm. guess is probably the best way of describing what it is, but we just try to walk with people and say, okay, if you're trapped in, you know, like a corrosive housing situation, okay, mm-hmm. well what are the things that we need to do to come alongside you and help move you towards a housing situation that's more sustainable and affordable in the long term, mm-hmm. okay, what are those, if you've kind of lived in if your like history of poverty has come to the place where it's begun to really break a lot of your key relationships, and you feel like isolated and alone, because that happens a lot, right? Because mm-hmm. you begin depending on other people's resources, mm-hmm. and if you do that to an extent, there's this like really evil way that not only do people in poverty like suffer like materially, but they begin to suffer relationally too. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so we say, all right, let's see if we can start knitting together, you know, some of those old relationships, you know, bring about some just healing on some of that stuff, but all, you know, also like let's help you form some new relationships that are going to be healthy for you for a longer way. Mm. And you know, that's, so some of that's just like problem solving, but it hopefully it happens over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, through that we begin to see kind of this, I mean, if you walk with people, you can find ways of helping them just recover their life, you mm-hmm, know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's some of what that means.
Yeah, and it's kind of going to be on a case-by-case basis. It's absolutely. Not going to be like, okay, everyone, we're going to dump you into this program and you're going to move through it and then, boom, everything's going to be better.
Yeah.
You know, it's more like, well, what does this individual need? Are they struggling with a substance abuse problem? Are they having marital difficulties or whatever it is?
Yeah, and so we end up doing, and that's kind of, I mean, this is like some of the beauty of it, but also some of what makes it hard, right, mm-hmm. to talk about, because you know, it becomes really, it really is about like walking with somebody and like listening to them mm-hmm. and knowing them and mm-hmm. like through that trying to, you know, help. From what they've always, you know, what are these places where they're just kind of tied down, man, you know, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. You know, as we over the last, so we've been doing this for like about 4 years in that kind of model. And, and you know, as we do that, you know, you find like kind of these new, some stuff is like repeatable, you know, because there are this, there are these like systemic things in our world, in our community. Like we have this real consistent thing going on in our community where, we have more distance between our population and available work, you know, and, in kind of, if it's not like, high skilled professional work, I mean, it can be really difficult to find sustainable income. And that continues to be even more true as just like the nature of industry in our area changes. You know, we're in Middle Tennessee, which is like, unionization is like really, really hard here, really difficult. And so we have a lot of people that work these manufacturing jobs, but in a temp status. You know, they're working for a temp agency, and they just get, I mean, they just get ground to death through that. And then people that aren't in that, you know, they're trying to make it work in like service sector jobs. And man, that's just so our people that work lines, like they'll get that manufacturing line work, and they'll have something consistent for 3 or 4 months, but then the temp agency will like move them somewhere else. You know, long before they get to the thresholds where they have to have medical care and
But
people that don't do that and they're in the service sector stuff, they might be able to have that job for a year, but they never get enough hours, you know, to make And so, you know, you see those kinds of repeatable things related to income and work. And some of that I'm really convinced is just, I mean, I think this is a real mystery for humans. Okay. To kind of pull back up to the 20,000 foot thing again, is that as the nature of human work is changing, partly because of technological stuff. Okay. As the nature of that's changing, like there's not enough of certain kinds of work to go around for us. I mean, there's just not. I mean, and we're not, I don't know that people are really talking about that in any kind of meaningful way. But the whole, just the kinds of conceptions that we have of like what normal work is, they're like breaking down.
Right.
Breaking down around us. And with that is, because of the way we've conceived of ourselves in kind of the industrial world, like the nature of like even what it means to be human is breaking down, because this central piece of what we think is our utility in the world, our usefulness in the world, is it's just kind of vanishing.
Yeah, right. Very quickly, so that we can't adjust quickly enough. Like, so people will say, well, I'll get more education.
Yeah.
But education for what?
Right.
Because by the time you're out, a lot of those jobs might not be there, might not be as needed. You know, so I was just listening to a podcast about how very quickly in the next 5 to 10 years, 50% of trucking jobs will be gone, because doesn't make any sense when you can have safer self-driving trucks to drive their trucks, when, you know, a million people are killed a year by humans making bad auto choices and killing people.
Absolutely.
When, you know, there'll be a few deaths with self-driving vehicles, but nothing like what we do, because we're terrible drivers in general, you know. So
And that has been like a very dependable
That's
like
the main
open
industry.
Option. Like if you have a CDL, okay, if you can get a CDL, then you have this access and there's like dependable work to be
right.
done there.
Okay. Right.
And so even that particular niche of employment, it has this capacity to just, you know,
vanish.
And
and it will vanish. Like that's the main job people are getting right now, as far as like because that's how we move through the distribution we have of how things get sold. That's the main way things are moved. And that will vanish, because the technology is there to change it over. And there'll be like trucking guardians, you know, they won't be completely unmanned, but you don't really need a trucker. You know, you could just have like a guardian there. You don't have to have someone who's trained that much. And so it's going to be very nerve-wracking and fearful for people who are like, well, now what do I do? You know, do I get do I bother getting training? Or, you know, yeah, you could get a PhD in something, but like no one's going to care. You know what I'm saying? Like, you could stay in school, I guess. But like,
well, there's technologies there too, right? Like, I mean, in the academy, you know, the academy's because we have all these other vehicles of like learning that are really being promoted, you know, technologically.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So the so education's breaking down because there's other delivery systems.
Yeah. So technology is all about like the multiplication of effort. Okay. Yeah. Which is really great because, like, you know, you can take that one person sharing their knowledge, you know, and they can receive that. Lots of people can differ. And there's cost to that. It's not the same experience. It's not, you know, watching, something on Udemy is not the same as having a, you know, course with a teacher in a seminar setting with, you know, 15 other people and you do that for 2 weeks. I mean, that's not the same experience. Okay.
Yeah, right.
But it approximates that experience at a drastically different cost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, there are some sets of skills that you can learn in that sort of setting, and so it changes the nature of all that. I mean, there's been times when I felt like, you know, pastorally, and there's, you know, a lot of the churches are like, you know, kind of fretting about how, you know, the nature of, you know, pastoral work over the next generations. You know, I've thought for a while, like, okay, like one of the best things about my work is that there isn't yet a robot that can do it. You know, like we're not quite to that place. But, you know, if you look into, you know, there are facets of my work where, okay, you might not be able to conceive of some kind of AI doing it in the same way. I hope that we're not to that place yet. But there are facets of work, of our work, which, you know, technologies, and I don't just mean like digital ones. I mean things like megachurch structures. That's a technology. Like the structure of the church is a technological piece, right? That it's kind of taking advantage of some sociological observations about people.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the function is that, you know, it collects that one single teaching message, okay, and kind of multiplies how many people are, you know, able to receive that. Or via like online and you know, the kind of like nature of receiving some kind of like Christian teaching is different. Okay?
Well, the teaching piece is different as far as like distribution, and you could say radio did that too. But I think, absolutely, you know, the bivocational pastor is getting more and more prolific. It's getting more and more common. But I think what we can never fail to realize, which will be really obvious when I say it, obviously, is that people are always broken.
Yeah.
And that'll always be a need, whether it's in, you know, counseling, pastoral, and that coming alongside piece like you're talking about. Oh my goodness, that's going to be even more needed. My goodness. Because the preaching side, delivering on the message side, might eventually, you know, in the church, institutions might kind of fade, but the whole thing of needing a spiritual guide or mentor
there is that but I'm say all that to call attention to just that even that even that kind of professional role, which I would have said you know, a few just 10 or 15 years ago, they'd been like kind of impervious to like technological change in some ways, it's not, it's really not in some ways. And and as you come to, you know, things that are there are just lots of forms, and not just on the spectrum of training, okay, but there are just lots of forms of work that are just so quickly changing. I mean, they're so quickly breaking down and changing, and that's it really provokes it breaks down the way that we think about humanity, because so much of that is in relation to our work. And as the nature of work is changing so quickly, I mean, it's kind of really, I think there's a lot of pressure on our understanding of human work and value. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because this crazy acceleration of technology like devalues human work, and it has, so it has the capacity of devaluing like human dignity in life too.
And that's what's really interesting, because if you go back to like agrarian times, you could almost say the same thing. Like, is it, how important is it to be a farmer or something like that. Like if you're just farming for your own family, is it really that prestigious? You know, but if you're a cleric or if you're a governor or something like that, oh, that's so prestigious. But if you're just farming for your family, is it really? And really, you're going to have people who are going to go back to very menial tasks because there's no other tasks to do.
Oh, yeah.
And then it's going to get down to, well, what is a human really, and what makes you important, and what's feeding your ego, or is there something else going on? So it really does get down to people's kind of root level insecurities about what it means to be human.
Yeah. And that and so that's part of the mix, too, right? Like when I mean, when I think about like Christian formation or spiritual formation, okay, part of it is to that we have some sort of understanding. We're not just performing some sort of rituals to make God happy. You know, we're also trying to create or uncover an understanding of humanity that that sustains its value in the face of those kinds of objections. You know, in the face of that kind of like misleading notions about what it means to be human. Okay.
Right.
But I don't know, you know, it's hard to know, like somehow some of this is like really recent and some of it's been developing, you know, it's like post-industrial stuff. Yeah. And, you know, some of that's just been in the air for generations, you know, I mean, like hundreds of generations, probably, as we kind of define ourselves by our capacity to work. And so for me, like missional living is to kind of like just try to be like really radically human, you know, radically alive in ways that are, you know, certainly we have some sort of understanding of productivity and creativity, all that, you know, that stuff that we talked about a second ago. But we also like have an understanding of like human value and dignity and community and life that is not directly tied, you know, it's not a result of our productivity. And that's something that has, like, you won't just get that out of the air culturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our culture isn't like sustaining that. So we kind of have to like kind of dig down deeper to where that kind of understanding of humanity is, like what is, and you know, I've heard some of your stuff on just like contemplative experience and prayer as a way of kind of like coming down to the gut level, like the deep level of like what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. Okay, and when we do that, it's experiential, but it also has this like missional touch to it, right? Because as I uncover that for myself, then I also reach out to that deeply human part of my neighbor too.
Yes, yes,
That's the kind of thing that I think, you know, the best mystics have taught us, is that when we really get to the understanding in our soul, in our deep part of our gut, like what it really means to be us, then it, even though there's this kind of misconception that contemplative like prayer can be isolating, right? Because it's something you do solitary, right? Actually, when you get to that point, when you uncover that part of your humanity, it frees you to reach out to your neighbor, your fellow human, in a different way, because you're not just, it's not just your mask reaching out to their mask.
Yeah,
it's your soul reaching out to their soul. It's your humanity reaching out to their full humanity, and that's a different sort of.
Yeah, because you realize you're made of the same stuff. There aren't these dividing boundaries and dividing lines, because you're like, oh, this is kind of at the image of God level that we're talking about, and you know, we're coming from the same source, the same place somehow, how that works, you know, where language is failing me now and going to fail everybody, I suppose, but I cannot get there really with English anyway, but you're getting to this point where you're going down deeply enough that the facades that you have and all the constructs that you have to understand who you are fall away, and then prayer and meditation and focusing on the most meaningful things about your existence really and your God connects you with God and others, and that's kind of how it rolls. And I don't know, I guess you can't know, and so that's why I maybe you can mention how to get in touch with your podcast that talks about prayer and some of these ways people can kind of encounter this material to kind of get more connected, because I would love to have people link up with you and what you're up to. Do you mind?
Yeah, sure. So the podcast is called Spiritual Steps, and it is intended to be, you know, just kind of like, you know, I try to keep it at like 10 to 15 minutes, somewhere in there. And we try to just, at each time, just have a some pretty concrete, you know, practical way of practicing spirituality. You know, that's really what the core of it is. And hopefully those are, I mean, they're not like meant to be cumulative in the sense that you kind of start at one and go all the way through, right? You know, you just pick up wherever. And I just find that, you know, if you have those pieces and you kind of add, if you are intentional and somewhat relentless, you know, and you kind of keep taking the next step, right? You know, that you kind of, that's the way you develop and grow and mature. And so, so it's called Spiritual Steps, and it's, you know, available on iTunes, okay? You can go to, my website is stephenhovetter.com, and there's a tab there for Spiritual Steps as well. And so you can connect in whatever, you know, way that is. Is that what you're, that's what you're asking, right?
Like, yeah.
Where to find it on the web or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when, so I try to release those things like once every week or 2 weeks, you know, depending on the zoo that is my life, whether I'm chasing like the next shiny thing or not. Try to do that. It's become kind of a discipline for me to try to put that out once or twice a week. And they're not meant to be like they're not experiential in the sense that you like listen to them and you need to be in kind of a meditative place, you know, to do that. They're more like, I guess they are kind of instructional, mm-hmm. in that they kind of provide something that after you listen to it, you would go and practice it, you know, mm-hmm. in some concrete way.
So. Yeah, it's kind of a how to and how to get started and what we're talking about. And there's one on centering prayer. There's breath prayer. And so those are kind of, and it's not like just a kind of, I think we touched on this before, but it's not like, here's a silver bullet to make your prayer life awesome and then everything's going to be great. You know, it's definitely not like that.
Yeah.
But sometimes we get a little bit caught up in like, oh, prayer has to be talking to God. And then we kind of lose, I don't know what to say about that, but it can grow stale and we can kind of not find our footing like we would in a contemplative way of approaching prayer and God.
Yeah. So there's, that's a great point of like kind of just pointing towards some distinction about what I'm trying to do there is I'm trying to get people, okay, so it's here, I find that a lot of the language around like contemplative stuff and a lot of the literature about it, it's like not accessible at all. Like I mean, I love myself some Merton, man, but you break open some Thomas Merton and that, you know, and it's like, your eyes are, if it's the first thing you've ever read about prayer, your eyes are going to like glaze.
Because he was a hermit for quite a while and we're not there yet, you know.
he's writing this stuff that happened after like 25 years of being in the monastery, right? And, you know, so, yeah, give me a, there's this, in fact, he like addresses this, right? Like in the prologue to New Seeds of Contemplation, he says, you know, in the earlier part of my book, it kind of came off like I was trying to teach people how to be contemplative. And I don't think you can do that because you might as well try to, what does it say? I can't remember what the metaphor is. He says, you might as well try to teach somebody to be an angel, you know, as teach them to be a contemplative, right? And I remember reading that and being like, well, thanks. That puts it completely out of reach for me, Thomas. but there is this sense that what people need are just these like, you know, these little first like baby steps. They just kind of get you going in the direction because that's what, to me, that's what contemplative life actually moves us to, is it moves us towards like consistency in the trajectory of that kind of prayer, right? And so what I've tried to do is just kind of help provide these, I mean, really introductory sorts of lessons of like, this is what it means to kind of collect yourself. Mm-hmm. And so those particular episodes like about, there's one on like just the prayer of gratitude, mm-hmm. you know, and that I think that's the first one. There's one on, there's an episode about like the prayer of solidarity. That's mm-hmm. actually that's the most downloaded episode, I think. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, This is really telling because I think our prayers, again, you know, there's this space where we feel like they, that is like an isolated, totally separate, devoid part of my life, right? And so, separate facet of my existence that's disconnected from everything else it means to be human in me. And I think we need these spaces where our prayer, where we begin to understand what it means to be people of prayer, and that has something to do with the rest of our lives too.
And definitely contemplative. I might have read this from Henri Nouwen, but that it might have been Merton too. Now I don't know. I'm totally blanking. But that it prepares you to go back out into community. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't mean, oh, I'm cloistered now. I fear going back into community, or I don't want to go back out anymore. But that is actually what fuels you for going back out in community, refreshed and enriched and overflowing with resources and love to be ready and able to add blessing and healing to the world. And so it's like it's and also you're kind of encouraging the same for others. So you're kind of saying this is how we are ready to be in the world and join up with the world and bless the world and not run and flee from it or pull other people out of the world and quick, let's get out of this dirty, messy world and make our own little kingdom separated from it. It's just like, no, we go back in and we get messy and then we do what we can to bring healing into the world, but not pull people away. Let's quick run to heaven.
You know,
and so I think that's kind of what contemplative offers us, is a way to connect with the world by first connecting with our deepest selves, which is where God is.
Yeah, that's right. I've been reading lately this text from Gregory. It's Gregory's Pastoral Rule. It's this, like, this ancient text and part of what he writes about there is he's specifically talking about people in moving into like pastoral kind of roles. And he speaks about how there's this risk that someone can fall so in love with the contemplative life that they aren't willing to like engage in the calling to be a part of human communities, you know? And to me, I think there is a place for the witness of like a pure, the sort of, a contemplative life that is, perhaps much more intensely focused on the life of the divine, okay? But to me, for most of us, what it really means to live in a contemplative sort of way in the world is to be able to have that sort of life of prayer that connects you deeply with creation and your own sense of what it means to be human and what it means to live with neighbors and... you know, and to do all that before the Creator. I mean, that's to me the real central nature of what it means to be contemplative in our world.
I totally agree, and that is not easy. Like that is really you need. I think you need divine help for that. I mean, that's the kind of thing where we can't trust in our own strength and ego and all that to get it done. That's why you need the support of others and the prayer to do it. I think that because that is a very big, you know, the example of Christ is the perfect, I feel like that is the perfect example. You don't find that Jesus did these marathon, you know, he was frequently in prayer, frequently away and gathering his thoughts and his prayer and readying himself for the day, which was going to be harrowing and difficult and full of sick people who needed his help. And so, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that our lives of being immersed in the world that's messy and, you know, full of tears and full of pain, that our lives won't need to look the same sort of way. And so, I mean, I think that, you know, good enough for Jesus, I think it's good enough for me. Well, Stephen, this has been amazing, and I really hope you'll come back again and speak with me again.
I would love to. That would be great. This is a lot of fun. And another piece of this whole thing, the podcast deal, is it kind of broadens you to this greater part of the world in, you know, a larger swath of you know, just the what I, you know, with people that are taking that same kind of spiritual journey in, you know, mm-hmm. it's always great, like my daughter says, to go and make new friends.
Go make new friends. Daddy, go make new friends. That's awesome, yeah.
You're... Well, next time we'll be old friends, okay?
Yeah, and, we'll be. Yeah, we've covered that territory, so.
Reconnected that way.
Yeah, definitely be in touch, and when you come up with some ideas we can chat over, I'm sure we okay. won't have any trouble chatting.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Wonderful. I'll be in touch, and thank you so much for this.
Come to sparkmymuse.com for show notes to this episode and all episodes. There will be links to the people, books, and resources mentioned in the show, and sometimes you'll find photos or embedded videos too, and lots of other goodies.